21. Martin Silenus had worked all afternoon on his epic poem, and only the dying of the light made him pause in his efforts. He had found his old workroom pillaged, the antique table missing. Sad King Billy's palace had suffered the worst of Time's insults, with all windows broken, miniature dunes drifted across discolored carpets once worth fortunes, and rats and small rock eels living between the tumbled stones. The apartment towers were homes for the doves and hunting falcons gone back to the wild. Finally, the poet had returned to the common hall under the great geodesic dome of its dining room to sit at a low table and write. Dust and debris covered the ceramic floor, and the scarlet tones of desert creeper all but obscured the broken panes above. But Silenus ignored these irrelevancies and worked on his cantos. The poem dealt with the death and displacement of the Titans by their offspring, the Hellenic gods. It dealt with the Olympian struggle which followed the Titans' refusal to be displaced, the boiling of great seas as Oceanus struggled with Neptune, his usurper, the extinction of suns as Hyperion struggled with Apollo for control of the light, and the trembling of the universe itself as Saturn struggled with Jupiter for control of the throne of the gods. What was at stake was not the mere passage of one set of deities to be replaced by another, but the end of a golden age and the beginning of dark times which must spell doom for all mortal things. The Hyperion Kantos made no secret of the multiple identities of these gods. The Titans were easily understood to be the heroes of humankind's short history in the galaxy. The Olympian usurpers were the Technocore AIs, and their battlefield stretched across the familiar continents, oceans, and airways of all the worlds in the web. Amidst all this, the monster Dis, son of Saturn, but eager to inherit the kingdom with Jupiter, stalked its prey, harvesting both god and mortal. The cantos were also about the relationship between creatures and their creators, the love between parent and children, artists and their art, all creators and their creations. The poem celebrated love and loyalty, but teetered on the brink of nihilism, with its constant thread of corruption through love of power, human ambition, and intellectual hubris. Martin Silenus had been working on his cantos for more than 2 standard centuries. His finest work had been done in these surroundings. The abandoned city, the desert winds whining like an ominous Greek chorus in the background, the ever-present threat of the shrike's sudden interruption. By saving his own life, by leaving, Silenus had abandoned his muse and condemned his pen to silence. Beginning work again, following that sure trail, that perfect circuit which only the inspired writer has experienced, Martin Silenus felt himself returning to life. Veins opening wider, lungs filling more deeply, tasting the rich light and pure air without being aware of them, enjoying each stroke of antique pen across the parchment, the great heap of previous pages stacked around on the circular table, chunks of broken masonry serving as paperweights, the story flowing freely again, immortality beckoning with each stanza, each line. Silenus had come to the most difficult and exciting part of the poem, the scenes where conflict has raged across 1,000 landscapes, entire civilizations have been laid waste, and representatives of the Titans call pause to meet and negotiate with the Olympians' humorless heroes. On this broad landscape of his imagination strode Saturn, Hyperion, Cotys, Iapetus, Oceanus, Briareus, Mimas, Porphyrion, Enceladus, Rhoetus, and others, their equally titanic sisters Tethys, Phoebe, Thea, and Clymene, and opposite them the doleful countenances of Jupiter, Apollo, and their ilk. Silenus did not know the outcome of this most epic of poems. He lived on now only to finish the tale, had done so for decades. Gone were the dreams of his youth of fame and wealth from apprenticing himself to the word. He had gained fame and wealth beyond measure, and it had all but killed him, had killed his art. And although he knew that the cantos were the finest literary work of his age, He wanted only to finish it, to know the outcome himself, and to set each stanza, each line, each word, in the finest, clearest, most beautiful form possible. Now he wrote feverishly, almost mad with desire to finish what he had long thought unfinishable. The words and phrases flew from his antique pen to the antiquated paper. Stanzas leaped into being with no effort. Cantos found their voice and finished themselves with no need for revision, no pause for inspiration. The poem unfolded with shocking speed, astounding revelations, heart-stopping beauty in both word and image. Under their flag of truce, Saturn and his usurper Jupiter faced each other across a treaty slab of sheer-cut marble. Their dialogue was both epic and simple, their arguments for being, their rationale for war, creating the finest debate since Thucydides' Melian dialogue. Suddenly, something new, something totally unplanned by Martin Silenus in all of his long hours of musing without his muse, entered the poem. Both of the kings of the gods expressed fear of some third usurper, some terrible outside force that threatened the stability of either of their reigns. Silenus watched in pure astonishment as the characters he had created through thousands of hours of effort defied his will and shook hands across the marble slab, setting an alliance against... Against what? The poet paused, the pen stopping, as he realized that he could barely see the page. He had been writing in half-darkness for some time, and now full darkness had descended. Silenus returned to himself, in that process of allowing the world to rush in once more, much like the return to the senses following orgasm. Only the descent of the writer to the world was more painful as he or she returned, trailing clouds of glory which quickly dissipated in the mundane flow of sensory trivia. Silenus looked around. The great dining hall was quite dark except for the fitful glow of starlight and distant explosions through the panes and ivy above. The tables around him were mere shadows, the walls, 30 meters away in all directions, darker shadows, laced through with the varicose darkness of desert creeper. Outside the dining hall, the evening wind had risen, its voices louder now. Contralto and soprano solos being sung by cracks in the jagged rafters and rents in the dome above him. The poet sighed. He had no torch in his pack. He had brought nothing but water and his cantos. He felt his stomach stir in hunger. Where was that goddamn Braunlamia? But as soon as he thought of it, he realized that he was pleased that the woman had not returned for him. He needed to stay in solitude to finish the poem. At this rate it would take no longer than a day, the night perhaps, a few hours and he would be finished with his life's work, ready to rest a while and appreciate the small daily things, the trivia of living which for decades now had been only an interruption of work he could not complete. Martin Silenus sighed again and began setting manuscript pages in his pack. He would find a light somewhere. Start a fire if he had to use Sad King Billy's ancient tapestries for kindling. He would write outside by the light of the space battle if he had to. Silenus held the last few pages and his pen in hand and turned to look for the exit. Something was standing in the darkness of the hall with him. Lamia, he thought, feeling relief and disappointment war with one another. But it was not Braunlamia. Silenus noted the distortion, the bulk of mass above and two long legs below, the play of starlight on carapace and thorn, the shadow of arms under arms, and especially the ruby glow of hell-lighted crystal where the eyes should be. Silenus let out a groan and sat again. "Not now," he cried. "Begone, goddamn your eyes!" The tall shadow moved closer, its footfalls silent on cold ceramic. The sky rippled with blood-red energy, and the poet could see the thorns and blades and razor-wire wrappings now. "No!" cried Martin Silenus. "I refuse! Leave me alone!" The shrike stepped closer. Silenus's hand twitched, lifted the pen again, and wrote across the empty lower margin of his last page. "It is time, Martin." He stared at what he had written, stifling the urge to giggle insanely. To his knowledge, the Shrike had never spoken, never communicated to anyone, other than through the paired media of pain and death. "No!" he screamed again. "I have work to do. Take someone else, goddamn you!" The Shrike took another step forward. The sky pulsed with silent plasma explosions, while yellows and reds ran down the creature's quicksilver chest and arms like spilled paints. Martin Silenus's hand twitched, wrote across his earlier message. "It is time now, Martin." Silenus hugged his manuscript to himself, lifting the last pages from the table so that he could write no more. His teeth showed in a terrible rictus as he all but hissed at the apparition. "You were ready to trade places with your patron," his hand wrote on the tabletop itself. "Not now!" screamed the poet. "Billy's dead! Just let me finish, please!" Martin Silenus had never begged in his long, long life. He begged now. "Please, oh please, please just let me finish!" The Shrike took a step forward. It was so close that its misshapen upper body blocked out the starlight and set the poet in shadow. "No," wrote Martin Silenus's hand. And then the pen dropped as the Shrike reached out infinitely long arms, and infinitely sharp fingers pierced the poet's arms to the marrow. Martin Silenus screamed as he was dragged from under the dining dome. He screamed as he saw dunes underfoot, heard the slide of sand under his own screams, and saw the tree rising out of the valley. The tree was larger than the valley, taller than the mountains the pilgrims had crossed. Its upper branches seemed to reach into space. The tree was steel and chrome, and its branches were thorns and nettles. Human beings struggled and wriggled on those thorns. Thousands and tens of thousands. In the red light from the dying sky, Silenus focused above his pain, and realized that he recognized some of those forms. They were bodies, not souls or other abstracts, and they obviously were suffering the agonies of the pain-racked living. "It is necessary," wrote Silenus's own hand against the unyielding cold of the Shrike's chest. Blood dripped on quicksilver and sand. "No!" screamed the poet. He beat his fists against scalpel blades and razor wire. He pulled and struggled and twisted, even as the creature hugged him more closely, pulling him onto its own blades as if he were a butterfly being mounted, a specimen being pinned. It was not the unthinkable pain that drove Martin Silenus beyond sanity. It was the sense of irretrievable loss. He had almost finished it. He had almost finished it. "No!" screamed Martin Silenus, struggling more wildly until a spray of blood and screamed obscenities filled the air. The Shrike carried him toward the waiting tree. In the dead city, screams echoed for another minute, growing fainter and farther away. Then there was a silence, broken only by the doves returning to their nests, dropping into the shattered domes and towers, with a soft rustle of wings. The wind came up, rattling loose perspex panes and masonry, shifting brittle leaves across dry fountains, finding entrance through the broken panes of the dome, and lifting manuscript pages in a gentle whirlwind, some pages escaping to be blown across the silent courtyards and empty walkways and collapsed aqueducts. After a while, the wind died, and then nothing moved in the City of Poets.